Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Devotion and Emotion and Anava Marga, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
Our Master Course Daily Lessons, Emerging with Shiva, is currently in Chapter 21. Total Surrender. The yoga of pure devotion is found at the beginning, the middle, and the end of the path. Merging with Shiva is more and more a deeply felt experiential reality when the soul gives of itself to Shiva inwardly and outwardly in unabashed devotion. Prapati, surrender, truly is the key that unlocks the love needed as merger increases as the years pass by, and as Satguru Yogaswami said, love pours forth to melt the very stones. Bhakti yoga is not an intellectual study, it is a practice. It is also not an emotional experience. It is a devotional experience. There is a difference which we will come to understand. Bhakti yoga is not a cure-all, nor a means to fast enlightenment. Rather, it is the foundation for enlightenment. It is not a technique, nor is it a magic mantra. It is a way of life. The transformation that comes from living in the state of bhakti yoga is the softening of the heart. So I had an interesting experience. Let me figure out when it was. I guess it was last November in Malaysia. We attended a seminar. It was on Hinduism and business. And so our part was purely religious. We gave a talk about work as worship and approaching whatever we do, including our time in the business world, including our time in the office, as worship. But what struck me was there were some other speakers who were, shall we say, traditional, inspirational business speakers. So they talk and you get excited, you know, and before you know it, you want to do something. You really don't know what you want to do, you know, but you feel like, oh, I should do something, you know. And so that's made me realize the motivational speaker, you know, how they work and how they stimulate emotion. It's because, you know, you get excited. That's what emotion means, excitement. So Gurudev is saying here that you know, we're not trying for emotion. We're not trying to get all excited in our bhakti practices. Rather, we're trying for devotion, which is a quieter, a non-excited type of feeling, a love for the deity, which is not full of excitement, but full of calm, shall we say. It's a more profound and therefore it's a more constant experience, because anything emotional goes up and down. You know, we get all excited, and then if we get excited, maybe we'll get depressed. You know, it goes the opposite way. Or you get very excited, then you might get very depressed. So definitely there's a big difference. And we'll look at that in a minute in the Shum, also this idea of devotion is different from emotion. External worship, bhakti yoga, is taught first on the spiritual path because it produces a softened, mellow heart. It is to waste the guru's time to give training in meditation and contemplation before the heart has been softened through bhakti yoga. The patient guru will wait until this has happened in the devotee. Otherwise, any accomplishment attained through intense raja yoga practices will not be sustained. And the problems that arise within the devotee's subconscious mind Should he be taught Raja Yoga before the proper preparation has been mastered, we'll go back on the guru. The guru will then have to act as the psychiatrist to solve the problems arising from the forced awakening. Whereas a mature bhaktar takes such problems or negative karmas, which are sometimes aroused as a result of deep meditation, to the temple deities, placing them at their feet to be dissolved. This will not happen for the devotee who is not experienced living in the state of bhakti yoga, because the relationship has not yet been established between himself and the gods. Therefore, the wise guru starts his devotee at the beginning of the path, not in the middle. So this is good advice, and as it points out in a little bit, unfortunately, it's not always followed in the West these days. There are consequences. But in terms of how Gurudeva used this principle in earlier years when Hindu temples were just getting established in the West, he for those in the West, he gave a strong emphasis on getting to know Lord Ganesha. In fact, that was about all everyone did for a few years. You know, make Ganesha a good friend and learn to develop a closeness, as it says here. And once you develop a closeness with the deity, and Lord Ganesha is the easiest deity to become close to, then you can take your problems to the deity. And because you feel a closeness, there is a mechanism at work there. If you don't feel a closeness and you take your problems, nothing happens. You go away with your problems. But if you have a closeness, you take your problems to the deity, you go to the temple, and something happens inside, and you get insights into your problems, or your problems totally go away, and you leave the temple, and you can't remember what your problem was. It's was such an effective process. But that whole process only works, as Gurudev was pointing out, once you create a closeness. Many Hindu teachers in the West teach purely Advaitic meditation with no theism or religious practice. But most who have come to the West from India were raised in Hindu homes. They have within them a firm religious cultural foundation for yoga. Many do not pass the religious culture on to their Western devotees, however. In an Orthodox Hindu community, they would most likely teach in a more traditional way. Dvaita philosophy is appealing to the Westerner. It does not require a change in lifestyle. So Gurudeva goes on. We don't have time to read the whole thing, but to explain that it's not a good idea to skip the devotional practice. And as he talked about before, you can run into problems, one of them being you end up in the subconscious mind and gets stuck there and just become aware of your personal problems through meditation. And of course, if that happens, you'll stop meditating, because who wants to look at problems all the time? So so if you start meditation without a proper foundation of devotion, then that's one of the possibilities. And certainly there's a lot of that going on. I keep running into new teachers every few months that are teaching meditation and weekend seminars in the West. You know, just 2 days and you get initiated and you're set for life. So easy, you know. But of course, it's not traditional. That's Great David's point. It's not traditional, and it can cause problems. So that relates to one of the basic shum meditations, which are called Mamsani. This is the one for March. La, Lam, Lof, and Lomp are the four words that are developed, and it brings up this same idea about the difference between devotion and meditation, but says it in another way, which I thought would complement it nicely. La, Lam, Lof, Lomp. These four images take us into the four states of being by naming them. In the English language, we only have one word for being, our great being. But the Shum Chief language names four states of being. This Mamsani brings together these four names. They actually name four vibratory rates of our being. We begin to meditate upon this Mamsani by reading from the top left clockwise. The first image is law. Law names the being of the physical body, or the feeling of the vibrations emanating out of our physical body. The next image in the Mamsani, Lam, names the vibration of our emotional intellectual nature, or the being of our emotions and thoughts. The next image is Lof. Lof is the name for the vibration, the radiation, the Shakti of the individual soul as experienced through the actinodic causal sheath, Vijnanamaya Kosha, in the fifth dimension of the mind. When one is aware within the center of the spine, Lof, an actinodic vibration, comes forth from the soul. This vibration oozes out through the physical body. This feeling is called Lof. Lof comes into power through Simshum BC when the forces are transmuted from the first three instinctive intellectual mind force centers, meaning chakras, and blends with the refined forces of the fourth chakra. After the Im Kaif experience, the beautiful Shakti that begins to emanate and become stronger and stronger through the years is called Lomph. Lomph is the vibration of the energies of the actinic body of a realized being, which develops and begins to grow after many Im Kaif experiences have been had. Law, Lam, Lof, and Lomph are four vibratory rates of energies which can be experienced singularly or in any combination. For example, one can feel the vibration of someone's physical body and emotional body, be they healthy or unhealthy, both at the same time. When an individual has matured inwardly and realized God, the most refined Shakti called Lomph can also be felt. This most important Mamsani tells our story, the story of our states of being. When we meditate upon it, we are seeing our superconscious existence, which will eventually come fully into existence after we have attained Im Kaif. We experience some days when divine energies flow through our bodies, when Shiva's cosmic energy sparks our mind. Now we have a name for this state of being, this energy, Lof. Lof describes our state of mind when Shiva's superconscious creative knowledge enriches our vision and the vision of others, improving the quality of life for all. When we experience our subconscious emotional feelings, good, bad, and mixed, we now have a name to call it, Lam. And when we are only aware of the external world and our physical body, we have a name for that too, Law. It is important in securing your unfoldment, where it is, that you really are very much aware of the difference in vibration between Lam and Lof, for one is often taken for the other. Very often Lam is emotionally taken to be Lof, especially when bhakti yoga and chanting is done by unfolded people. This accounts for religious fervor and emotionalism. So that's a little deep, but it ties in there in that idea that we want to distinguish between Lam and Lof in that terminology, or between emotion, excitement, and devotion, which is calm, love, and intelligence from the sub-superconscious, and strive for the latter. So we don't have a lot of emotion in our activities. You know, we don't get all excited. Sometimes I end up at the youth groups, Sai Baba chanting youth groups, you know, and they get excited. <You know? laughs> They don't chant in a calm manner. You know, it gets very excited, and everyone, of course, gets uplifted, but it's emotional, so it will dissipate because it's just an emotional excitement. It's not truly an awakening of devotion. It's more, some devotion's there, but it has the element, just when the youth do it, not adults, but the youth get excited, that sense of emotionalism comes into the singing. Whereas if you hear someone sing Devaram, for example, there's no emotion involved. It's more just a pure devotional practice. And that's why some who like modern music feel that traditional Devarmana are too boring because there's not enough emotional content present. But it's just a different style of music. Well, thank you very much. Have a wonderful phase. Good morning, everyone. Our current Master Course lesson from Merging with Shiva has to do with the Anava Marga, which is a term Gurudeva coined. You won't find that in someone else's book. And it's a term he coined to describe the path of the egocentric person, someone who has a very strong, someone who's very self-centered and very concerned about themselves and proud person, someone on the Anava Marga. A powerful businessman, a bum on the street, a highly educated scientist, and the uneducated field worker could all be sharing the Anava Marga. It is a path of gratification of the ego or the gratification of other person's egos. These days, egos get gratified by going to heads of corporations, meeting important people, and bowing before heads of state. It is on the Charya Marga, the path of service, that we learn that rich and poor, the powerful and lowly are all Purushas, pure souls, jivas encompassed in a physical body. And on this Marga, the Marga of service, we learn to bow before God and the gods. We learn that their home, their officiating place, is the temple, the home shrine and under sacred trees. Being in their presence makes the Charya Margi feel small. The first glimmer of the feelings of smallness is the first footstep on the Charya Marga. Though the one who has little desires the most, he takes issues with the smallest things. The instinctive desire to save face is ever prevalent in his mind, for his face is all he's got. He doesn't have anything more. The rich and this is a difficult word here, anavikali, here we go. Anava as an adverb, anavikali. The rich and anavikali powerful can buy new things. And when something goes wrong in life, change their image by retreating into their money, place, prestige, and come out anew. Those full of anava who have satisfied, put to rest the many desires of life, entering the Charya Kriya and Yoga Margas, gain a new spiritual face, a light in the eye, and become looked up to even more than they were when they sought out for donations for worthy causes. So the idea there is in our Saiva Siddhanta. Before we become a religious person, we're not religious. And one of the qualities of not being religious is we have a strong sense of ego, strong sense of pride, concept that we're right when others are wrong, and it's just the way we are. It's a normal state of mind that you grew up in, and unfortunately our education system, university system, quite often supports that. And so someone goes into the university somewhat humble, but they come out not at all humble. They manage to lose whatever humility they had in the process, and they come out very argumentative, thinking they're smart, and they're smarter than you are, and they've learned how to defeat you in arguments. Even if you're right and they're wrong, they still have the ability to make it look like they're right. Those are the skills you pick up in the university. So it's natural when we get to that point in life that we have a challenge with the Anava Marga. So that challenge is overcome in Saivasiddhanta by worshiping in the temple. And that's the point that Gurudev is making here. Just the act of going to the temple and worshiping the deity being greater than you are, acknowledging that the deity is greater than you are, is a step off the Anava Marga. It's a step into religiousness. So that's why Gurudeva emphasizes in all his writings the importance of developing devotion, the importance of going to the temple on a regular basis, because it softens the ego. It lessens the ego that we've built up through life and through study in a natural way. So just to remind us what Anava is, Lexicon defines Anava as the impurity of smallness, the finitizing principle. Then goes on to say that Anava is the individualizing veil of duality that enshrouds the soul. The presence of Anava Mala is what causes the misapprehension about the nature of God, soul, and world, the notion of being separate and distinct from God and the universe. Anava obscures the natural wisdom, light, unity, and humility of the soul and allows spiritual ignorance, darkness, egoity, and pride to manifest. That's what we were talking about. Darkness, egoity, and pride manifesting. It is inherent in a maturing soul like the shell of a seed. When Anava is ripe, anugraha, grace comes, and Anava falls away. Anava is the root mala and the last bond to be dissolved. So I created an analogy, simple one. A simple way to grasp the concept of Anava is to think of a bucket and the ocean's water. That's something we can relate to in Hawaii. You can dip the bucket in the ocean and lift it up. The water that is now separate, the water that is in it is now separate from the ocean. The bucket is like Anava. It has separated a small amount of water from the ocean's water. Water is consciousness, a small amount of which is now separate. So the bucket, simple analogy to think of Anava. There's a verse in the Ajurveda which describes it, not through analogy, but gives the same concept. A part of infinite consciousness becomes our own finite consciousness. With powers of discrimination and definition and with false concepts. This spirit is consciousness and gives consciousness to the body. So that's a nice way of saying it. A part of the infinite becomes finite. Or the water in the ocean gets in a bucket, becomes finite. Last part's the best. A story. This is one of the Yogaswami stories. I started at the end because it's a pretty long story. After breakfast, Yogaswami asked us not to throw away the banana skins, which were for the cow. So that's true recycling, right? When the banana skins are used in a useful way. He spoke loudly to the cow that was grazing in the garden. The cow clumsily walked right into the hut. Advantage of not having doors. And he fed her with the banana skins. She licked his hand gratefully and tried to sit on the floor. Yogaswami held out the last remaining banana skin to the cow and said, "Now leave us alone. Don't disturb us, Vali." It's the cow's name. "I'm having some visitors." The cow nodded her head in obeisance and faithfully carried out his instructions. After the cow had left us, Yogaswami closed his eyes again and he seemed once more to be lost in a world of his own. I was indeed curious to know what exactly Yogaswami did on these occasions by closing his eyes. I wondered whether he was meditating. Obviously, this person doesn't know a lot about meditation. It was an apropos moment to broach the subject, but before I could ask any questions, he suddenly started speaking. "Look at those trees. The trees are meditating. Meditation is silence. If you realize that you really know nothing, then you would be truly meditating. Such truthfulness is the right soil for silence. Silence is meditation." Yogaswami bent forward eagerly and continued, You must be simple. You must be utterly naked in your consciousness. When you have reduced yourself to nothing, when yourself has disappeared, when you have become nothing, then you are yourself God. The man who is nothing knows God, for God is nothing. Nothing is everything. Because I am nothing, you see, because I am a beggar, I own everything. So nothing means everything, understand? Tell me about the state of nothingness, requested my friend with eager anticipation. It means that you genuinely desire nothing. It means that you can honestly say that you know nothing. It also means that you are not interested in doing anything about this state of nothingness. What, I speculated, did he mean by know nothing? The state of pure being in contrast to becoming? Yogaswami continued, you think you know, but in fact you are ignorant. When you see that you know nothing about yourself, then you are yourself God. So that's the end of the story. Oh, here's my bhasya. This is certainly an informative story, and it shares a number of important points about Yogaswami's teachings. The most dominant point made has to do with nothingness and not knowing. In life, the normal emphasis is on acquiring knowledge. That is, replacing a lack of knowledge on a subject with knowledge. For example, we purchase a new computer and know little about its operating system. Therefore, we need to read the manuals, talk to experts, and end up acquiring enough knowledge to operate the computer. We have replaced a lack of intellectual knowledge on a subject with knowledge. However, Yogaswami's approach is the opposite. We start with intellectual knowledge about God and strive to rid ourselves of this knowledge. When we succeed, we end up experiencing God. Why is this? It is because the intellect cannot experience God. The experience of God in his personal form and his all-pervasive consciousness lies in the superconscious or intuitive mind. And the experience of God as absolute reality is even beyond the superconscious mind. Yogaswami had a simple phrase that captures the essence of this approach to God realization, which is, it's not in books, you fool. Acquiring clear intellectual concepts of the nature of God is good, but these concepts must be eventually transcended to actually experience God. One of Chalapaswami's Mahavakyam, Great Sayings, also emphasizes the same idea. It is Nam Aryom, which translates as, we do not know. In Gurudeva's writings, the same idea appears in his cognizant ability aphorisms as, quote, the intellect, strengthened with opinionated knowledge, is the only barrier to the superconscious, unquote. Gurudeva goes on to explain that a mystic generally does not talk very much, for his intuition works through reason, but does not use the process of reason. Any intuitive breakthrough will be quite reasonable, but does not use the processes of reason. Reason takes time. Superconsciousness acts in the now. All superconscious knowing comes in a flash, out of the nowhere. Intuition is more direct than reason, and far more accurate. Thus we can clearly see that the same idea is being expressed by all three gurus of our Kailasa Parampara, which is that the experience of God is only possible when we have transcended the limited faculties of our intellect and the concepts it has about God, and dive more deeply into our superconscious, intuitive mind, and beyond. Said another way, clearly the experience of emptying ourselves of our intellectual concepts about God needs to precede filling ourselves with the experience of God's holy presence within us. So, thank you very much.